This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk with our own co-host Marjorie Cohn about her recent Truth Out article titled Israel Authorizes Military to Kill Palestinians with Drones in the West Bank.
Israel has been using killer drones to target and assassinate Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, but this will be the first time the Israeli occupying forces use killer drones in the occupied West Bank.
We're also joined by Dr. Andy Lee Roth, Associate Director of Project Censored.
We talk with him about the disturbing censorship by the government and by corporations of the news media.
Stay with us. I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org.
In October, the Israeli government announced that commanders of the Israeli occupying forces have been authorized to use armed drones to kill Palestinians in several parts of the occupied West Bank, with the approval of Chief of Staff Lieutenant General Aviv Kohavi. Since 2008, the Israeli Air Force has been killing Palestinians in Gaza with drones, especially during protests against the annexation wall and colonies. Drones have also been used to fire gas bombs and live rounds at residents in cities, towns, and refugee camps of occupied Jerusalem. Drones are employed for surveillance, but this is the first time that weaponized drones will be used in the occupied West Bank. Drones make up 80% of the total flight hours in the Israeli Air Force. Here to discuss this disturbing development is our own Marjorie Cohn, who recently published an article in Truth Out titled Israel Authorizes Military to Kill Palestinians with Drones in the West Bank. Marjorie is a legal and political analyst who provides commentary on local, national, and international media. She's professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, a member of the Bureau of the International Association of Democratic Lawyers, and the Board of Veterans for Peace. Her most recent book is Drones and Targeted Killing, Legal, Moral, and Geopolitical Issues. Marjorie, welcome to the other side of the microphone on Law and Disorder.
It's so great to be with you, Heidi.
Marjorie, what do you think led to this authorization for the Israeli military to use weaponized drones to target and kill Palestinians in the occupied West Bank?
Well, this mid-October authorization to expand the use of killer drones coincides with, according to the Jerusalem Post, a significant rise in shooting attacks and massive gunfire during arrest raids, specifically in the northern West Bank cities of Jenin and Nablus. And on September 28th, before the authorization, the Israeli occupying forces killed four Palestinians and injured dozens more during protests in Jenin.
How does Israel justify targeting Hamas and Islamic Jihad?
Well, Israel justifies targeting them as so-called terrorists with drones for their counterterrorism operations if armed gunmen are thought to pose an imminent threat to Israeli troops. But Israel does not have a right to self-defense against the people whose land it occupies. The Fourth Geneva Convention says that an occupying power has a legal duty to protect the occupied, and as the occupying power, Israel cannot use military force against the occupied Palestinian people. Because we hear Israel talk all the time about self-defense, but Israel does not have a lawful right to self-defense.
Do the Palestinians have a lawful right of self-defense against the Israeli occupying forces? And if so, please explain why.
Well, yes, Heidi, under international law, the Palestinians have a lawful right to resist Israel's occupation of their lands, including through armed struggle. In 1982, the United Nations General Assembly, quote, reaffirmed the legitimacy of the struggle of peoples for independence, territorial integrity, national unity, and liberation from colonial and foreign domination and foreign occupation by all available means, including armed struggle, unquote. That's in a UN General Assembly resolution, and the General Assembly is the democratic body of the UN. It includes all of the UN member countries.
On October 25th, Israel carried out the first targeted killing in the West Bank in more than 20 years. Please explain what happened.
Well, this was a raid against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus, and it killed a leader of a Palestinian militia group and four other men. The group is called Lion's Den, and many Palestinians support this group's fighters as popular heroes against the occupation of their lands. Israel has blamed the Lion's Den for a rise in shootings that it says are aimed at its troops and Jewish settlements in the occupied West Bank. And also, in addition to the five people killed in the Nablus raid, at least 20 Palestinians were injured.
Marjorie, has Israel been targeting journalists who report from the occupied West Bank? And if so, how?
Yes, more than 40 Palestinian journalists have been killed since the year 2000. Israel assassinated journalist Shireen Abu Akleh just days after a coalition of Palestinian journalist organizations and leading human rights lawyers filed a complaint in the International Criminal Court protesting the systematic targeting of Palestinian journalists.
Who was Shireen Abu Akleh, and what exactly happened to her?
Well, she was a beloved Palestinian-American journalist, often called the Voice of Palestine, and in May she was reporting on an illegal Israeli occupying forces mass arrest raid on the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank when she was assassinated by an Israeli sniper. And the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court classifies the targeting of war correspondents or journalists who report from war zones or occupied territories by killing or physical assault as a war crime.
And how have the Israeli and the U.S. governments explained Shireen's death?
Well, Israel initially denied that it was an Israeli who shot her, blaming it on Palestinians. Later, Israel said there was a high possibility that she was accidentally hit by Israeli Defense Forces gunfire. But on September 20th, Palestinian human rights organization Al-Haq and London-based research group Forensic Architecture issued a report finding that Israeli forces repeatedly and deliberately targeted Abu Akleh with a well-aimed bullet. She had a vest on that said press in large, clearly visible letters, and a helmet. And she was clearly, the press designation on her vest was clearly visible to the Israeli occupying forces shooter, as shown in the detailed digital reconstruction from Al Jazeera footage. And the only part of her body, her neck, that was not covered with a bulletproof vest or a helmet is where the Israeli sniper aimed at and killed her.
That is chilling, especially with the uptick in violence against journalists everywhere.
The United States, in spite of overwhelming evidence that Israel intentionally targeted Abu Akleh, refused to criticize Israel, as they never do. They never criticize Israel, almost never. Even the U.S. government has implicitly bought into the Israeli narrative that this was an accident.
Well, Marjorie, on that note, can you talk a bit about how the U.S. government supports the Israeli occupation of Palestinian territory?
Yes, the U.S. government provides Israel with $3.8 billion annually in military assistance. And the Biden administration has refused to condemn the assassination of Abu Akleh or condemn Israel for its illegal terrorist designations and raids on six or seven of the leading Palestinian human rights groups. This happened last October when the six leading Palestinian human rights groups that support women, children, farmers, etc., were labeled as terrorist. And then early this year, there were raids on and shuttering of the offices of those groups and a seventh group, and yet the Biden administration refuses to condemn it. And Joe Biden has twice refused to meet with Abu Akleh's family face to face.
I understand that some Palestinian journalist organizations filed a complaint in the International Criminal Court on behalf of Shireen's family. Can you elaborate on that?
The same day that Al-Haq and Forensic Architecture released their report finding that Israel had targeted Shireen Abu Akleh, the International Federation of Journalists, the International Center of Justice for Palestinians, and the Palestinian Journalist Syndicate filed a complaint in the International Criminal Court on behalf of the Abu Akleh family and journalist Ali al-Samoudi, who was also shot by Israeli occupying forces at the same time as Abu Akleh. Al-Haq is one of the six Palestinian human rights groups that Israel baselessly designated as terrorist organizations and one of the seven raided by the Israeli occupying forces.
On October 31st, following a months-long investigation, Democracy for the Arab World Now, or DAWN, asked the prosecutor of the ICC to investigate senior Israel military lawyer Eyal Toledano for war crimes and crimes against humanity in the occupied West Bank. Who is Toledano and what did he do?
He is a senior Israeli military lawyer, a colonel who served as the Israeli Defense Forces West Bank legal advisor between 2016 and 2020. And this organization, DAWN, Democracy for the Arab World Now, after a months-long investigation between 2016 and 2020 in the occupied West Bank, in an almost unprecedented request, asked the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court to investigate him for war crimes and crimes against humanity. Many organizations have submitted complaints to the ICC about Israeli crimes and victims, but it's extremely rare for a complaint to focus on an individual culprit. And Toledano was the top-ranking legal authority in the occupied Palestinian territory, basically the attorney general of Israel's occupation. And he was responsible for the legal planning and approval of all non-combat activities and policies of the Israeli occupying forces, including several that violate international humanitarian law and the Rome Statute of the ICC. And he planned, approved, or oversaw acts and policies that constitute war crimes and crimes against humanity, including hundreds of home demolitions causing forced displacement, collective punishment through punitive home demolitions, arbitrary restrictions on movement, facilitating the transfer of settlers to the occupied territory, and advancing de facto illegal annexation and maintaining an illegal system of apartheid. He and his staff of 20 lawyers oversaw 618 home demolitions, which displaced over 2,000 Palestinians in the occupied Palestinian territory, and that violates the international humanitarian law prohibition on the destruction of property and forced displacement, which constitute war crimes. And Toledano also authorized dozens of punitive home demolitions against innocent family members of alleged militants, and that violates the prohibition on collective punishment. He played a key role in planning, justifying, and defending the planned but not yet carried out mass demolition and forced transfer of the entire village of Khan al-Ahmar, which would be a war crime. And he's responsible for authorizing sweeping restrictions on movement both within the occupied West Bank and arbitrary travel bans denying more than 10,000 Palestinians, including human rights defenders, permission to travel overseas. And that violates their freedom of movement under international human rights law. So, taken together, what he is accused of doing is committing the crime of apartheid under the Rome Statute for the ICC, which occurs when an inhuman or inhumane act is carried out in the context of an institutionalized regime of systematic oppression and domination by one racial group over another with the intent to maintain that system. According to Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International, Israel does have a system of apartheid, including punitive home demolitions, discriminatory home demolitions, forcible transfer, and the denial of basic rights like severe restrictions on residence and movement. And Toledano has authorized, supervised, or carried out each one of these things. And the crime of apartheid, in addition to being a crime against humanity, the crime of persecution is also a crime against humanity under the Rome Statute. So there are many, many war crimes and crimes against humanity that Toledano has been charged with, according to this complaint by the Democracy for the Arab World Now.
And if that doesn't shock the conscience, Israeli warplanes have been shelling civilian neighborhoods in the Gaza Strip. How many Palestinians have been killed in recent days, and how has the Palestinian resistance movement responded to this?
Well, let's go back to November 3rd, when there was shelling in the West Bank city of Jenin, and a Palestinian child was killed, and two other Palestinians were killed, and three were injured by Israeli soldiers. Another Palestinian died as a result of the wounds that he received, and three others were injured and are being treated in a hospital. And then the following day, November 4th, Israeli warplanes shelled civilian neighbors in Gaza. And the spokesperson for Hamas, Hazem Qassem, said Israeli bombing will only make the Palestinians more determined to resist the occupation and increase their support for Jerusalem and its people. Since January, over 160 Palestinians have been killed by the Israeli occupying forces, and 51 of those victims died in the 3 days of the Israeli attack on Gaza last August.
Speaking of the apartheid state, progressive journalist Katie Halper was recently censored and fired by The Hill for defending Representative Rashida Tlaib's characterization of Israel as an apartheid state. What dangers does Halper's firing pose for journalists to report critically about Israel?
Katie Halper is a U.S. journalist, and she was censored and fired because, of course, the corporate media in this country, working hand in glove with the government, will not abide any criticism of Israel. But Palestinian journalists face death, and we saw this with all the Palestinian journalists that have been targeted and killed, including Shireen Abu Akleh. According to Jennifer Robinson, who is a lawyer for the Abu Akleh family, the killing of journalists is an attempt to cover up and prevent their work in documenting human rights abuse, and it fosters impunity for the injustices that they are seeking to cover. So, Heidi, there's a reason that these journalists, both in the U.S. and with more deadly effect in Palestine, are being targeted, and that's because they are shining a light on the illegalities that Israel is committing in the course of its illegal occupation of Palestinian territory and the human rights violations that are devastating the lives of the Palestinians.
Marjorie, listening to all of these developments is disheartening, to say the least. What can our listeners do to take action?
Well, people can support the BDS movement, boycott, divestment, and sanctions. And if you want to learn more about it and what products are being boycotted, you can go to bdsmovement.net, and it explains the campaign and it explains all of the different products that are being boycotted: Sabra hummus, Hewlett Packard, many other products. And it really is having an economic impact. In fact, a few years ago, Netanyahu called the BDS movement an existential threat to Israel, right up there with Iran, which is also not an existential threat. But BDS is having an impact. I would strongly urge people to get involved in that BDS movement.
And how can listeners follow your work, your writings, and your historical documents that I think have been making this case for years?
Well, I write a weekly column for Truthout, but my articles, books, video, and audio interviews are largely collected at my website, marjoriecohn.com. And of course, people can tune into Law and Disorder, where you frequently interview me about many of these topics. That is, when you and I aren't interviewing other activists.
Well, Marjorie, if it wasn't such a depressing topic, I'd say it's been a real pleasure, but it has definitely been enlightening and should spur people to action.
Well, thanks so much, Heidi, for doing this program, and I really appreciate the opportunity to be interviewed about this.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
States has a disinformation problem so endemic that the government says it threatens our national security. Yet effective solutions have proven elusive. When the Department of Homeland Security created a disinformation board this April, critics from all sides denounced it as a potential tool of censorship. And that's no surprise, given that censorship is on the minds of many. During the past school year, more than 1,600 books were banned, according to a PEN America report. And the cancel culture movement teeters between a tool of accountability and outright shaming, often with little regard for the truth. Since 1976, one group has been working to raise awareness about censorship in our society and the urgent need for media literacy. Founded as a media research program, Project Censored focused on student media literacy and critical thinking skills as applied to the U.S. news media. In 1993, the project began publishing an annual book with a list of what it considered the most significant but most underreported news stories of the year. Dr. Andy Lee Roth is Associate Director of Project Censored. Along with Mickey Huff, he co-edits the State of the Free Press yearbook series. He also helps coordinate the project's Campus Affiliates program, which links students and faculty at 6 U.S. college and university campuses in a collective effort to identify and vet important but underreported news stories. Andy joins us today to talk about the 2023 edition of Censored, the news that didn't make the news and why, that will hit bookstores in December. In addition, the Censored Press and Triangle Square Books for Young Readers recently published The Media and Me. It contains critical thinking skills, practical tools, and real-life perspectives intended to help young adult readers become independent media users. Andy Lee Roth, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much, Heidi. Pleasure to join you and Marjorie today.
Andy, the 2023 edition of the Censored Yearbook is dedicated to Russ Kick. Who was Russ, and what did he stand for?
Russ Kick was a champion of freedom of information, and he stood for so much that aligns with what Project Censored is all about, the idea that we need information to be well-informed and engaged as community members and citizens. Russ's work... He's a champion of the Freedom of Information Act and using the Freedom of Information Act to make information that government agencies didn't want the public to know about. And the one that always sticks out in my mind is his partnership to get the photos of the flag-draped coffins coming home from Iraq and Afghanistan, which the U.S. military did not want the public to see. And I think that the work that Russ did on that and one of many such projects that he was engaged in was so crucial in helping us understand the human cost of war. So we were really saddened by Russ Kick's death. It's a terrible loss to anyone who values freedom of information and freedom of expression. But we were pleased to dedicate this year's book to him, and we hope that, you know, in some small way, the project continues a little bit of the legacy that he leaves.
Let's begin with a couple of definitions. How does Project Censored generally describe modern censorship?
We define modern censorship as anything that interferes with the free flow of information in a society that purports to have democratic institutions and a free press. So this broad 21st century definition includes the kinds of censorship that many people think of when they hear that word, kind of prior restraint type censorship. You can't print that, you can't broadcast that. But it also includes other indirect and unintentional forms of censorship. We know, and I know that the two of you so frequently address, things like algorithmic censorship, digital gatekeeping.
The 2023 edition of the book Censored references a term called censorship by proxy. What does that term mean, and can you give us an example or two?
Yeah, I mean, one way to come into this is to go back to a quote from a book by Timothy Garton Ash from 2016 about free speech, where he noted that Google may not be a country, but it's a superpower. Mickey Huff and I have been developing this concept. Mickey Huff, the director of Project Censored, and I have been developing this concept of censorship by proxy in conjunction with the work of our colleague Avram Anderson at Cal State University Northridge. It's a new type, a relatively new type of censorship that is defined by three key features. Censorship by proxy involves restrictions on freedom of information that are undertaken by private corporations. We can come back and say a little bit more about that in a moment. Where these restrictions on freedom of information exceed what would be possible by governmental regulation, and where these restrictions serve both corporate, private corporate interests, and also the interests of either government agencies or other third parties. One of the key points of censorship by proxy, and it fits, it's an example of why we need a modern 21st century definition of censorship, is that it's not subject to First Amendment prescriptions on government interference with freedom of speech or freedom of the press. So one or two quick examples. Earlier this year, two outstanding independent news organizations that Project Censored often keeps tabs on for their investigative reporting, Consortium News and Mint Press News, both had their PayPal accounts frozen, suspended for, quote, unspecified offenses and risks associated with their accounts, according to PayPal. Those suspensions were eventually lifted after there was public protest and outcry over the suspensions. But briefly, PayPal was literally throttling Consortium News and Mint Press News, both of which have a history of critical and reporting and commentary on U.S. foreign policy, NATO, including NATO involvement in the Ukraine, and the Consortium News editor-in-chief, Joe Loria, said that he believed this was a case of, quote, ideological policing. But that isn't even, as Mickey and I note in the introduction to this year's State of the Free Press book, that's not even the most glaring example of censorship by proxy that we've seen in the last year. After Russia's fateful invasion of Ukraine in early 2022, responding to public protest, four major kind of media platforms, DirecTV, Roku, Sling TV, and Dish, all dropped RT America, which was the U.S.-based, English-language-based version of RT, the Russian news agency. So the U.S. government didn't shut down RT America, as many people think. It was actually deplatformed by DirecTV, Roku, Sling TV, and Dish. But we make the case in a forthcoming article that Mickey Huff, Avram Anderson, and I researched that you could see the government interests at stake here if you go back prior to the invasion. Back as early as January of 2017, there was a joint intelligence community assessment that was looking critically at Russian media, including RT in particular, that assessed that it was serving Russian interests. This is, of course, in the aftermath of the 2016 U.S. presidential election. And that paved the groundwork for, in November of 2017, the Department of Justice pressuring journalists at RT America to register as foreign agents under the Foreign Agent Registration Act. And as the Committee to Protect Journalists noted, the stigma for RT America reporters of having to register as foreign agents, even when many of them were themselves U.S. nationals, made it difficult for them to do their work. So you can see here, it's a kind of complicated connect the dots, how without having to shut down RT America, the U.S. government was able to act perhaps in concert with some of these other media outlets, private for-profit corporations, to achieve a result that would have been, I think, politically difficult, if not impossible, as a matter of a governmental act, direct action.
Boy, that is very worrisome, Andy. Project Censored has a robust classroom initiative and a censorship guide for teachers. Your recently published book, The Media and Me, focuses on teaching young people critical media literacy. Please tell us about these resources and why they're so important now.
Yeah, The Media and Me came about because this book that will be coming out next month, along with the next Censored Yearbook, The Media and Me came about because wherever we were going as Project Censored, people were saying, well, your campus affiliates program focuses on college-age students. What about people who are younger? You know, we need to start having a critical take on news and media generally for younger-aged people. And so I want to give a shout-out to Dan Simon, our long-term ally at Seven Stories Press there in New York, for encouraging Mickey and me to put together a team to write this book that became The Media and Me. So it's a book about critical media literacy that is distinctive because it's the first book about critical media literacy, which I'll explain in a moment, that is targeted specifically to young people. There are other books about critical media literacy and the importance of teaching critical media literacy, but they're mostly directed to adults, teachers and parents and the like. And this book that we wrote is directed to young people themselves directly. The idea of media literacy is that there are a collection of skills that people need to have to be able to make good sense of the media that are such an important part of our lives. And most definitions of media literacy then play on the idea that those skills include knowing how to access, knowing how to analyze, evaluate, and even create media in a variety of forms. And critical media literacy adds in, my background is as a sociologist, and so I'll put it in sociological terms. To me, the critical dimension of critical media literacy comes from thinking about power, thinking about the distribution of power and how it affects relationships and life chances. And not all media literacy programs do that, but critical media literacy, which is very much the vein that The Media and Me, this forthcoming book is about, is focused on critical media literacy. If I could, the metaphor I like to use is if you imagine an old-fashioned wristwatch or clock with the hands that where the big hand points to the minutes and the small hand points to the hours, and you can read time by knowing the relationship between those hands and the numbers on the clock. Most of us, if you think about use of media, it's like being able to tell time, right? We can do it to be functional, to achieve what we need to achieve. You know that when, you know, these arms are aligned this way, that it's 1 o'clock in the afternoon. What critical media literacy does is say, let's go beneath the surface. What's underneath the face of the clock? What are the gears and the wheels and the springs that drive the hands on the clock? And if you understand what's going on beneath the surface, the structures, the framing, and so forth, you can really look at media with a very different set of eyes. You can engage in media but much more critically, with circumspection where circumspection is necessary, and with confidence when you can look at media and say, oh, this is valid, this is a well-documented news story, it's well-sourced, it's got evidence for the claims that are made in it. So we're really trying to reach out with this new book, The Media and Me, to reach a younger but absolutely crucial audience, and I can't wait for the book to come out.
So what is critical media literacy?
We in the United States are, I think, behind other nations, especially other European nations, in having media literacy education as part of the school curriculum. But before we get excited and say, oh, we're catching up, there's a battle, as there are in all media, I think, environments. There's a kind of battle going on over whose version of media literacy will prevail in the schools. And right now, there are strong kind of corporate-based movements promoting media literacy, but not of the sort that I and my co-authors of The Media and Me would be thrilled about. A media literacy that says that we should trust people from the Department of Defense to tell us who's producing reliable news stories is not the sort of critical media literacy that I hope for our future. So I think, you know, when people hear about media literacy programs being advanced, say, in their state or in their school district, I think it's very important to look at who is behind those efforts and to think, as we urge in the Media and Me book, to think about what the interests might be of those entities. So this is very much part of, I think, as critical media literacy becomes more prevalent in the United States, it too will become a kind of contested ground on which different versions and different visions of what media literacy might consist of will be squaring off with one against one another.
My co-host Heidi Boghossian and me, Marjorie Cohn, are talking to Andy Lee Roth from Project Censored about censorship by the government and its proxies. Andy, for the 2023 Censored Yearbook, how do you identify stories for inclusion?
That process is a year-long process that was basically now... It harkens back to the founding of Project Censored in 1976 at Sonoma State University in north central California. It's a year-long process that involves no fewer than five different steps during which stories are being identified, vetted for their accuracy, their significance, their trustworthiness, and ultimately voted on by our international panel of judges who many of them are current or former editors or journalists themselves. Others are media scholars of great reputation. We have a former FCC commissioner on our judges. So the process begins with students in classrooms, in college and university classrooms, identifying stories of potential interest, and as well as, I should add, community nominations from people who follow the project and are interested in our work. And those stories are then vetted through this kind of four or five stage process that I'm describing here. And ultimately, each year we produce a list of what we consider to be the 25 most important but underreported news stories of the year, or the so-called, quote, censored stories, as we call them.
Andy, let's take a sneak peek at a couple of the stories in this year's forthcoming top 25 list. One involves surveillance advertising. It's story number 10 on the list. What is that?
So surveillance advertising is an increasingly ubiquitous and profitable practice engaged in by social media apps and platforms such as Facebook, YouTube, Instagram. But that's not necessarily news per se, but this story is about how the Federal Trade Commission earlier this year is seeking to regulate the collection of user data, right? So an effort by the FTC to, in effect, rein in some of the surveillance advertising that has been so profitable for social media platforms over the years. This story that we're bringing forward was originally broken by Lee Fang in The Intercept in February of this year. Fang reported on how FTC efforts to regulate the kind of surveillance advertising collection of users' data is being pushed back against by the Interactive Advertising Bureau, which is basically a trade group that represents media outlets that use digital advertising, that are profiting, in other words, from surveillance advertising. And so part of Li Feng's report is the conflict of interest that many major news outlets are in fact engaging in the same. They have worked with the IAB, the Interactive Advertising Bureau, to profit from surveillance advertising of their own, and now they're not reporting on the IAB's efforts to oppose and potentially thwart the FTC's regulation of surveillance advertising. So it's a classic conflict of interest story. As Li Feng wrote, major news outlets chose not to cover the story because they would have had to acknowledge the awkward reality that they're engaged in these practices, they're profiting from these data aggregators themselves.
Andy, story number 17 is a 2021 progressive piece exposing a former neo-Nazi who now holds a counterterrorism position with the Department of Justice. Wouldn't a federal background check have uncovered this? And why should this be a concern?
Almost certainly. So the person we're talking about in terms of the federal background check, almost certainly. The person we're talking about is Brian Houghton, who holds an important counterterrorism position in the Department of Justice. He's the law enforcement coordinator for domestic counterterrorism in the Mid-Atlantic Great Lakes Organized Crime Law Enforcement Network. But as the Progressive reported, as Helen Christophe of the Progressive reported, Houghton has a well-documented, publicly documented history of everything from playing in neo-Nazi bands in the 80s and 90s to connections with the Aryan Republican Army, which was linked in the mid-1990s to the Oklahoma City bombing, to up until Houghton became a member of the Philadelphia Police Department in 2017. To me, the interesting thing about this story is not so much the single individual, but as the Progressive reporting noted, the FBI has long known that white supremacists were seeking to get jobs as police officers in order to access intelligence and to get weapons training. That's going dating back to 2006. The FBI was publicly acknowledging that it was tracking that dynamic. So here we are 15, 16 years later, and seeing this kind of high placement, and you know, this jibes with some of what we know about what happened on January 6th. So the surprising thing to me is, on this story, is that although we do have reporting in NPR, The Washington Post, New York Times, other kind of establishment news outlets about former or current police officers with ties to white supremacist organizations, when we looked at this particular case, we found that the Progressive was alone in having covered this particular individual and their prominent position in the Department of
Justice.
Andy,
Project Censored is producing high-quality, timely material on one of the greatest threats to our democracy. How can people follow you and the project's work?
You can find us, although we're critical of social media, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. You can also go directly to the project website, projectcensored.org, and you can ask for our books, State of the Free Press 2023 and The Media and Me, a Guide to Critical Media Literacy for Young People. In early December, you can ask for those books at your local bookshop. You can also, I should add, sharing the airwaves with you on WBAI, Wednesday mornings, the Project Censored radio show airs at 10 a.m. That's hosted by my project colleagues, Mickey Huff and Eleanor Goldfield. So you can also check out on the website, you can also check out the archives of the Project Censored show, which has been on the air for, I believe, 12 years now.
That's right. We're both on Pacifica together. We're related. Andy, thanks so much for being on Law and Disorder.
It's a pleasure to join you and Marjorie. Thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder, www.lawandisorder.org.
this hammer and cat to my captain. Tell him I'm gone. Tell him I'm gone. Tell him I'm gone. Take this hammer and cat to my captain. Tell him I'm gone. Just tell him I'm gone. I'm sure he's gone. This is the hammer that killed Johnny Ray, but it won't kill me, but it won't kill me, but it won't kill me. This is the hammer that killed John Henry, but it won't kill me, but it won't kill me, ain't gonna kill me. It's a long ways from East Colorado, honey, to my home, honey, to my home, honey, to my home. It's a long ways to East Colorado, honey, to my home, honey, to my home. That's why I'm gone. John Henry, he left his hammer, plain side the road, plain side the road, plain side the road.